We talked to a fair number of people who have emerged from spiritual journeys to find a new and better version of themselves. In the case of Cheryl Stray, the author of Wild, it was a physical journey as well. Our guest this hour herself took a long road, in the abstract sense, to get to where she is today. Sarah Marshank started in a Jewish family in Michigan and took a number of twists and turns in her life to get things right. She tells the tale in her book, Being Selfish, an unorthodox memoir. Sarah spent 10 years in retreat to find her own pathway and offer it to others as selfistry. Sarah teaches and speaks internationally, facilitates online courses, and works one-on-one with individuals. And because she lives in Southern Oregon, we have her here at the table. Thanks for joining us, Sarah.
Thank you, Jeff. I'm glad to be here.
So if someone picks up this book thinking it's a me-first manifesto based on the title, Being Selfish, how disappointed might they be?
Well, I chose that title on purpose to be a little bit provocative around that, because there's so much bad rap around being selfish in the conventional sense, where we see a lot of people really just going for their own self in the sense of wanting more prestige or power or love or attention, which is all normal and natural in our human development. But there's something about my story that's looking for the deeper self, which is why if you look at the title of the book, it's Being Selfish. So I think that a reader will be disappointed in the sense that it's not a conventional selfish story, but it certainly is a journey to the self that I did by myself.
Like any good memoir, you start in the middle, but can we go back a little bit? Can you sketch your childhood just a little for us in the Detroit area?
Sure. I grew up in Detroit, and I was born in 1963, and my family actually lived in the city. And so I like to say that I was born 9 months before Kennedy was shot, and really could feel that I was born into a time that was very racially tense and also kind of, you know, breaking open in the world around sex, drugs, rock and roll in the 60s. And I was born to a Jewish family, a second child out of five. And we moved out of the city in 1968 when I was 5 years old, and the National Guard was called in. For those of you listeners who are old enough to remember that.
Riots in the streets of Detroit and many other cities as well.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
For very similar reasons to what we have going on now.
Exactly. It's quite ironic and a little bit heartbreaking.
So as we meet you on the page in the book, you're struggling with a decision. Second of its type. Tell us about that.
So the decision is around whether to birth a child or not. The book does start in the middle, as you said, and it is one of those moments that many women confront in my generation, and it's a topic that is often not discussed. And it's incredible to even mention the word abortion, how much controversy there still is over that. Not just the word, but the experience and how much of it is kept hidden. So I start with full disclosure on my internal struggle with having to make a decision for the second time.
So by the time of that decision, I mean, what was your attachment to religion or spirituality in some form?
Well, that's a good question. I was always very curious about the nature of being human and why we were here and what it was all about. But I had been pregnant prior to this one pregnancy that you enter the book on. And that choice to abort that child was very easy in a way. I didn't have a lot of I didn't have any moral judgment about it because of the way I was raised. But something inside me was heartbroken about it. And so by the time, and you'll read in the story, the second pregnancy came very unexpected. Both of them were had birth control was being used. So, and raised in America in a very liberal culture, I didn't have any shoulds around whether it was a right or wrong thing to do. And yet that second choice really was more of an existential, you could say, spiritual crisis. Not so much that I was worried about killing a life, but more I was worried about the implications in my being about what does it mean to be human and care for life. Sometimes caring for life is taking it. We do that with animals often. So for me, it wasn't whether or not I made X decision or Y decision, but how do I make that decision?
Even if you didn't think of it as a place you go, were you thinking in terms of you would end up in hell for that decision?
I didn't really believe that, but I wondered, you know, I had moments of like, oh, shoot. You know, I'm not allowed to swear on radio, am I?
Correct.
Okay. Oh, shoot. Am I going to hell? That would really kind of suck. So, yeah, it kind of blew open all my questions about every religion and what were they saying and what was the point. And so it really, for some people, it's a kind of a slow journey to ask these questions. And for many of us, it's some sort of life trauma or life event that makes you go, whoa, am I in trouble?
And that was a whoa moment.
That was a whoa moment.
So that addresses your level of attachment to spirituality or not at the moment. Then let's talk about your attachment to your family at the time. And there were some hits and misses there, clearly.
Yeah, you know, I have a lot of respect now for what it means to be a parent. It's a huge job. So, you know, my connection with my family, I was very close with them at the time, and yet I was really on a journey of differentiating and trying to find my own way. So I was in my early 20s at the time. I'd already left Michigan. I went to University of Michigan for a couple years and dropped out because I didn't feel like it was really giving me what I needed. And I moved to Santa Cruz, California, moved to the West Coast where things were happening. And that's where my journey in the book began, in California.
So family and spirituality together now, how deep was your thinking about God or a higher power growing up or any of that?
That's a good question. I was raised conservative in a conservative Jewish family. So basically, I actually went to private school when I was young. So I speak fluent Hebrew, and I was given the, you know, the historical and religious point of view of Judaism. And my father was more connected to the lineage than my mother. But we were basically, you know, middle class, liberal, open minded intellectuals more than we were religious per se. But I was bat mitzvahed.
Okay. So. I love the description of your mother keeping as kosher as your father required of her.
Exactly.
Other than that, I was like, whatever. What's
yeah.
the kosher stuff? Okay.
Yeah.
And for the folks who are not familiar with Judaism, conservatism is sort of in the middle, isn't it? I mean, you got Orthodox conservatism and Reformed.
Yeah.
Judaism, okay.
Yeah, and renewal is even farther, humanistic. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Sarah Marshank, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Being Selfish, an Unorthodox Memoir. Note the play on words there. We'll come back and talk more about her spiritual journey and how that can be applied to other people, yourself included. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Sarah Marshank and you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Sarah Marshank, Southern Oregon resident and author now as well. Her book is called Being Selfish, an Unorthodox Memoir, My Journey from Escort to Monk to Grandmother. So Sarah's gone through a long spiritual journey that she shares with us in the book and gets us into the idea of selfistry, a program in which you can be your own guru. We'll get further into that as we go through the hour. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. So to get back to where we are in the memoir, you had struggled with the decision over having a second abortion. Had it produced a bit of an existential spiritual crisis in you. You began to look for some other things to go to. Who turned you on to the Kabbalah, and how welcome was the advice?
I was turned on to the Kabbalah by a friend of a friend who, it was an interesting story because she's a woman who was studying Kabbalah and actually translating some Kabbalistic texts for a rabbi in Israel who didn't know she was a woman. She was doing it via email at the time. So she was fluent in Hebrew and she was Orthodox. She was called a Baal Tshuva, which is a Jewish person who was not born Orthodox, which is the most extreme and most, Orthodox of the Jewish tradition. And so I studied with her. I began to study with her. And then at that point, there were already a lot of English books out there that talked about New Age, Kabbalistic, esoteric Judaism.
I think about Madonna embracing the Kabbalah along the way. It's the kind of thing that does seem to get a little trendy from time to time. You ended up in some classes, though, with a rabbi. What was that about? And in fact, it was the challenging of the rabbi that makes that an interesting section of the book.
I ended up studying in yeshiva, which is a school for deep study of Jewish religion in New York. And the scene you're talking about in the book is one of my teachers, the head rabbi of the yeshiva, who I challenged on a very fundamental question of the Jewish narrative of why we're here and what it's all about.
The idea of Adam and Eve and original sin, and that God set it up to for there to be sin.
Yeah, like what kind of God would set it up that way? That just didn't seem like the guy, kind of God that I wanted to hang out with.
Have you stumped a few religious leaders over the years? I mean, it sounds like your questions have always been somewhat probing.
My questions have always been probing, and the greatest teachers for me were the ones that were actually willing to receive my questions and answer them from the place I asked them.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But how many of the people were able to meet you at least halfway like that?
You know, in the end, Sam was the one who met me the most there.
Okay,
and that one didn't even last either. Okay, but we won't go to him yet.
Well, no. I was going to say we can get to Sam, but I want to broaden out just a little bit first, because we've been talking a lot about internal stuff going on in your life, and I want to get some external life circumstance. You talked about moving to Santa Cruz. Let's talk about going to college. You mentioned going to the University of Michigan. What was your idea for your career? What were you going to do for yourself and establish your life after college?
I love that question, because it does weave together with what I'm doing now. Is I was into alternative education. And one of the reasons why I left the University of Michigan, I was studying education and sociology and psychology and philosophy, and I did an alternative education program out in New Hampshire with a bunch of really incredible professors. And that experience out in nature, studying Emerson and Thoreau and Emily Dickinson, kind of ignited in me a passion to live more before I could teach more. And so I left University of Michigan, had some friends who were living in California, moved to Santa Cruz, went back to school in Santa Cruz at UC Santa Cruz, and continued my degree in alternative education there.
Okay. In working our way toward the mythical Sam, I mean, Sam is a real person, but just not that name.
Yeah.
There are some composites in the book, I understand, too.
Yes, but Sam is not one.
Okay.
He is
All
one.
Right.
Yeah.
How had your relationships been up to the point in your life when you were in Santa Cruz?
You mean like love relationships?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I had my first real long-term relationship was with the man I had my first pregnancy with, and that was when I had already moved to Santa Cruz. And prior to that, I was very, I was one of these kids that could kind of be friends with anybody. So I had a lot of different social groups, from, you know, the druggies to the cheerleaders, and was very interested in just the variety of humans and belief systems on the planet. So I was more of a group person and a friendship person than a love relationship.
Sarah Marshank is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her memoir is Being Selfish. You mentioned the fact that your parents were fairly liberal in some senses, but at the same time were conservative Jews. By the definition of conservative Judaism, how much pressure was there from them to find a life partner, to find a husband, anything like that?
Not a lot. I think more of it was subconscious or unconscious for them, just wanting all their kids to be happy. And in their mind, there was a conventional sense that get married, have kids, get a real job, and live happily ever after. But they never pressured me in that way, especially my father. They really supported my intellect and my creativity. I'm also an artist. And so I had a lot of room.
So let's talk about ending up in a class with Diana, who taught you and several other people about sexuality. I mean, how do you end up in a class like that in the first place? What was the entree to it?
My experience with Diana was after the second abortion, and I had at that point graduated UC Santa Cruz and done some graduate work and was back in Michigan studying at the time. And I was searching, I was seeking, I was kind of a classic seeker at that point. And so I found her flyer on the local health food store and went to check it out. And started studying with her. Yeah.
What were you studying? What were some of the basic concepts taught?
So she taught a Native American lineage. And so she was teaching basic, kind of what she called it was a twisted hair lineage, which is from different tribes of Native American, and very westernized in the sense of intellectualized and turned into kind of a hybrid teaching. But it taught me about the seasons and the equinoxes and the solstices and how to have a connection with the land and the cycles, and also their whole kind of paradigm around what does it mean to be human and what does it mean to be spiritual.
So as you take in new spiritual concepts, and it sounds like you've always been fairly open-minded about them anyway, but I mean, I just wonder how much how much of puzzle making goes on in your head at the time, figuring, okay, these pieces work together. This one doesn't. This one's going to go off on a different shelf because this is no longer part of this puzzle anymore. I mean, how tricky a process for you is that to figure out which concepts you still hold and which ones you no longer need?
I love that question. It's really great because I'm still doing that. And really, that's what sophistry is about. And the answer is to really, I gave myself permission and I felt like I had enough, confidence and enough intelligence and heart to sort it out if I had enough time and if I had the opportunity to experiment. You know, it wasn't just a cognitive process. It was an experiential process. And I trusted myself when something, quote unquote, felt right to me. It wasn't a superficial felt right. It was from deep inquiry and exploration.
So is sophistry at its core giving yourself permission to explore a lot of other concepts and not necessarily have to do full Velcro adhesion to any one set of beliefs?
Exactly. And to learn how to explore mindfully and carefully. I was a little extreme and reckless at times. I don't advocate for that. I advocate for a slowing down and a sincere inquiry and a willingness to open to other perspectives and try them on.
But you gave yourself over, pretty thoroughly at times. And let's talk about Sam. This is where he comes in the book. And it sounds like he's very much a deep thinker.
Sam's brilliant. He really is. And very heartful and very devoted to the truth, capital T. He's a beautiful human being.
And he's got an interesting term for meditation, I noticed.
Which was?
Sitting.
Yes. He just stripped it away. Because it's funny because I was listening to a podcast yesterday about meditation and I said to my husband, I said, gosh, you know, when somebody uses that word nowadays, I think it's really important to define exactly what you mean by that or what you're doing because there's a whole spectrum of experiences and practices that people are calling meditation that aren't the same and have different intentions. So Sam was really clear. You're going to sit down. You're going to shut up. You're going to not move, and you're going to listen, and you're going to see what's there.
Sarah Marshank, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Being Selfish, an Unorthodox Memoir, My Journey from Escort to Monk to Grandmother. This is a conversation you're welcome to join. We're talking about spiritual exploration and having the power to do your own. Not necessarily with guidance from other people, but I gather they help from Sarah's book. You can join us as we talk about self-history and what that means. 800-838-3760 to come in by phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. So back to Sam, the man who calls meditation sitting. Sit down, shut up, just be quiet. How different was he and your time with him from anyone else you'd known or cared for before?
Well, I had never had any real experience with meditation until I met Sam. So that was new to me. And by the time I met him, it felt like a huge relief, Jeff, I have to say, because all of these other teachings that I'd studied, Judaism, Native American, I was doing yoga, I was trying different diets, I was in psychotherapy, I was really trying to do everything to sort it out. And Sam basically said to me, honey, you're not going to fit. It's not outside of you. Just relax. Just sit down, listen, contemplate, study, slow your life down. You'll sort it out. It's in you. And that was a huge relief, even though at the same time it was also, oh my God, are you kidding me? I can't figure this out.
That was the next question, was how daunting or scary or enlightening it was to be told, no, it's not out there. You got to dig inside.
It's incredibly overwhelming initially, I think, for everybody, because how do you sort through all of your beliefs and all of your shoulds and all of your what everybody's telling you the truth is and come to a sense of really self-knowing? It's a journey. And my journey, in essence, began when I met Sam and continues to this day.
So it's not a matter of just saying, okay, I now junk everything I learned between the ages of 10 and 14 or forget what I learned between 23 and 26. It's really figuring out the stuff that you feel is best for you?
I guess the way I would language is it is really a process of discriminating. So first of all, kind of tearing it apart, breaking it down. What are those things that are basically common to all of the lineages that I've been introduced to and I've discovered? And so there's certain threads that come through, like being still and being quiet. That's in every tradition. And so before there came this dogma or this recommendation to do a certain practice or say a certain prayer or do a certain mantra, there was a deep listening. That's where all the mystics initially discovered their connection with the divine.
So did Sam follow any set of practices that had been developed for a long time? Did he start there and move off into his own realm? I'm just kind of curious about where he was able to go for himself and then how he was able to help you find a similar path for yourself.
Sam was his journey was similar to mine. I met him a little bit farther along, is the case, and he had already studied a lot of Western psychology and spirituality, and he got hooked by Zen, and he actually sat with at the Zen Center in San Francisco for a while before he decided to just do it on his own, because there was already so much protocol and ritual within the Zen lineage that felt like it impeded his own deep listening. So he took the structure of how to meditate, how to sit a session, and just did it on his own. He was a fiercely disciplined man, which is one of the things I really admired about him and why I wanted to spend time with him.
So then, ta-da, you follow Sam to his home, the Rogue Valley. This is your first trip here that you write about. Everybody knows about the flights into Medford, all that sort of stuff. That was quite a first meal and discussion, though. You described going to the hometown buffet in Medford with Sam, and was it Robert?
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about that encounter.
Well, Sam had a very critical and keen eye in exploring and examining the human predicament. And so I began my relationship with him really taking a moment to take stock. And I really advocate for that. And so we just looked around at others and ourselves. How do I eat? What do I eat? How do I think? What am I thinking? How am I feeling? Where are those feelings coming from? So it was a huge opportunity to look.
But this is the part of the book when I think a lot of people go, what? Because Sam is celibate?
Yes.
And continues to be that way? We don't know.
We don't know.
But his friend Robert was not, and you agreed to an exploration of sexuality with him, which is going to be a step pretty far for some people. How big a step was it for you?
Well, what I like to say about my experience with sexuality is that for all of us, there's going to be certain areas of our lives that are worthy of a deep exploration. And so it wasn't so much about the sex per se, though it's certainly fascinating, and I'm happy to talk about that. For me, it was more about the willingness to really try on and explore. And you could do this with politics, you could do this with diets, you could do this with music, you could do this with anything. Sexuality is such a core part of our human beingness. For me, it felt like the natural place to explore all of the ideas and beliefs and shoulds that came down to me that weren't actually telling the truth about who I am as a sexual being.
Well, it is also one of those things we don't talk about easily, which is an interesting place to go then if you're trying to pull the lid off your own spirituality and find out what's inside you as you explore places where people do not generally dare to go.
That's a beautiful point. And, you know, nowadays, this generation with gender diversity now, there's a much more openness to talk about sexuality and abortion and pregnancies. But still, it's got huge stigma and shadow around it. It's heartbreaking.
Sarah Marshank is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Being Selfish, an Unorthodox Memoir. So the different voices in which you write, you know, sometimes you're in straight up type, sometimes you're in italics, which gives us the sense that at least at the point in your life that this part of the book deals with, like coming to Medford for the first time, you hardly accepted anything on first pass without the other voice in your head, the one in the italics saying, "You sure you want to do this?" Is that pretty much the way things were?
Yeah. Isn't that for you also? I mean, I think it's for all of us in a way. We have all these different voices, and who's the real self, you know, inside? And that's part of the journey and the inquiry that I was on. Who's the real me? What's really true for me?
So of all the things that you explored, and we're talking about everything from traditional Judaism to Vision Quest. I don't know if there was peyote in here. I hadn't gotten that far in the book. Okay. There's a no on that one.
Sober on that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
But were the any that repelled you from the get-go or made you laugh when somebody said, "This is how we practice this"?
That's an interesting question. I don't think anybody's asked me that. I think in general, I was really open to everything, though I had more of an inclination towards a tradition like Zen as opposed to, let's say, Tibetan Buddhism, which is so ornate in a way, or Christianity or Catholicism and the rituals around that. I think I was looking for something really down to earth and something that really made sense before I layered onto it all these other accessories.
So the conversation about working for an escort service, how did that come about?
So that came through a vision quest and a woman that I met on the vision quest when I was already doing a certain degree of exploration with my sexuality. And when I met her, I got curious about what it would be like to be an escort. And I had already done a lot of study around sacred spirituality. And there's a lot to unpack around that. So in this brief conversation, what I would want to say is that I was doing it as a way of a self-discovery. And it was safe, relatively safe, however safe that can be. And it was a fabulous journey for me. I did it for 3 months. I wasn't on the street, you know, trying to get money to survive. It was more of, you could say, an undercover journalistic opportunity. And I learned so much from it. It was really beautiful, actually.
The discussion with the person who ran the escort service that is included in the book, was sitting at a table with a friend, and the friend is surprised. I mean, were you surprised at yourself, or was this the kind of thing that it came along at the right time?
It came along at the right time. But of course there was a part of me, and you read about it in the book, that italicized voice going, "Are you crazy? What would your father say?" So yeah, that was definitely in there. But there was more of a curiosity and a willingness to really inquire about the social constructs that we have set up around sexuality that are so dishonoring to men especially and their sexual drive, and also to women and our desire to be free sexually without needing to get married or have children.
All right, we'll pick it up there on the other side of a break. Sarah Marshank, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Being Selfish. It's a memoir, and she talks about selfistry for everybody, if you'd like to go along with that ride, which is the idea of being your own guru. We'll get into that in more detail when we come back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Rogue Valley resident Sarah Marshank. She has written a memoir called Being Selfish, subtitled An Unorthodox Memoir, My Journey from Escort to Monk to Grandmother. It's a very long spiritual journey that Sarah has embarked upon. Don't know if it's finished yet, but she encourages the rest of us to take some inspiration from what she's done and embrace something she calls selfistry, where we can actually be our own gurus. We can talk about this with you. You're more than welcome to join the conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So coming to the escort part of the journey here again, you just talked about some of the cultural constructs and limitations about sexuality, particularly for men. Tell us about that a little further.
Well, what I just said to you on the break that I'd like to reiterate here is that it's important when we're discussing this part of my journey to put it into a context so that the listener can understand really what the whole intention was around this. Again, going back to a core desire to kind of break apart social constructs and discover an authentic way of being, in this case, sexual. And I noticed as I was a teenager growing up with a fair amount of sexual freedom that it was much harder in a way for a man to express his sexuality without being labeled, a monster in a way. And there was very little freedom for him to just be purely sexual. It was always wrapped around. And many of our cultures actually mandated this. Well, you get married at a young age, so you have a place to channel that energy. And yet we're living in America. I was born in the 60s, and all of those cultural expectations had been changing. So I was curious about how for men, they felt a need to marry me, or at least take me out for dinner and buy me flowers before we could be sexual. Whereas there's a natural and beautiful movement in humans to be sexual for sexuality's sake. There's also a drive for procreation, a drive for intimacy, in some lineages a drive for enlightenment or a drive for healing. But there's also just this beautiful and natural drive to simply be sexual for the pleasure of being sexual. And we don't have the freedom to do that without a lot of stigma. And women get labeled a slut or a whore or we're so ashamed even to acknowledge this aspect of ourselves that we feel like we have to take drugs or alcohol to free it rather than being sober. And that's what I loved about escorting. We were sober. It was safe sex. It was a clear communication. It was a clear contract. It was adults. And really, for me, all of the men that I worked with were beautiful human beings.
I think what comes out at this point then as really interesting is the idea that for a lot of people in the West, religion or church in the traditional sense means you learn a code of conduct, you learn what the rules are in society with you and your God and all that stuff, and yet your spiritual journey involved pushing all the walls out, taking down all the fences and saying, okay, we're going to start from bare earth here and figure out what it is to be human.
Yeah. I needed to burn the house down and start at the foundation again. And I was really excited that we could say I tore the house down. I didn't burn it because I still had a lot of good hardware there to use. And I'm really all about upcycling in general. So I'm happy to take some from every lineage, but to build my own house and be my own guru, but not in an isolated way. I'm an advocate for discovery within community, to having Sam and I were deep partners on the journey of inquiry. And I continue to this day to have many people in my life who are willing to challenge me, who are willing to be challenged, and are willing to stay with the inquiry until we all get to a place of, yeah, this really is right.
So the character of Sam, not his real name, asks you at one point what you want. And my recollection is you pretty much screamed it at him. I want it all. Did you know what all was? And he asked it.
I think at that moment in that scene, and I remember it, and there were many times with Sam because he kept driving for the core, the essence, the heart, what I call the core self or the authentic self. And there were so many other me's around at the time. I was like, I want everything. I want to get married and live happily ever after. I want to be a monk. I want to be an artist and I want to be a writer. And I think all of us have a variety, if not all of them, a variety of desires. And how do we choose? How did you decide to be sitting here being a radio show host and not being a neurosurgeon?
Have you seen my hands? let's take a call. We have Sandy in Mount Shasta on the line. No surprise that he's calling. Welcome, Sandy, to the Jefferson Exchange with Sarah Marshank.
Yeah, I'm finding this to be a very intriguing conversation. I almost turned the radio off when I heard it was going to be about spirituality because I'm somebody who spent a good deal of my life first trying to find meaning through psychology, and when I felt like that failed me, then I turned to spirituality and tried out a whole bunch of things and spent 16 years as a member of a spiritual teaching school that ultimately I felt like failed me. And so I've been very skeptical ever since, but I'm really curious. You strike me as kind of intuitive, and you strike me as somebody who's really balanced in a way that I have not heard a lot of other spiritual teachers. I don't know if you identify yourself as that, but I found that in my experience with a large group of people who were organized around one person's particular approach, that the thing that turned me off ultimately was there was this reverential, I'm not against reverence, but when people start acting like they think somebody's a god, whether they actually voice that or just show that in their attitude. So I'm curious to hear you say more about what you call, what is the name for your?
Self-history.
Self-history, yes. Could you say more about that? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Danny. Thanks for the call.
Thanks for that question. That's beautiful. One of the things that I got really interested in the last 12 years since I've been out of retreat, so I spent 10 years in retreat with Sam, doing deep practice and study and exploration in a very isolated structure. It was pretty much Sam and I and a small group of people, so we didn't really look out to any teachers. But in the last 12 years, I've had the privilege and the opportunity to spend time with many teachers. And what I've discovered is, and this might help you understand where self-history is coming from, is that there's a notion in adult human development that we're kind of at an evolutionary cutting edge here around our capacity as humans to actually be self-aware or to actually look at ourselves from an objective point of view. And so selfistry is based upon the notion that we all have the capacity, we're growing into it. Some of us have it more developed than others. It's this possibility and the permission that you mentioned earlier to actually stop and take a look and wonder and get curious about, does this really feel right? And it's not, does it feel right emotionally? Like, oh, this feels good. But at a core level, does this feel true? And we all have that capacity to assess that. And the whole guru model, I think, is crumbling. It's one of those beams in the house that I tore down, that to put our trust in another is different than to put our whole life into the hands of another. So I value my teachers, but as you know from the book, I advocate for self-discovery, no matter how long it takes.
And in fact, the line that you use with selfistry on your website is become your guru. So well, and to Sandy's question, though, do you consider yourself a spiritual teacher in the sense of spiritual teacher? I mean, do you expect some reverence when you deliver your messages?
Reverence is not the word that I would use. What I say is I'm a very serious practitioner and a teacher. And like you had asked me, I'm trained as a teacher, so I like teaching and I enjoy it and I think I'm fairly good at it. But I would never ever ask a student to take my advice without validating it for themselves inside of themselves first. And sometimes there's a process there where I'll make a recommendation. Here, try this. I think it might work for you. Try for 3 months, this kind of meditation, for example, and then report back to me. Let's see how it's working for you. You tell me, is it working? And I think nowadays we have so many different methods available to us to try, so many beautiful teachings and lineages that we can extract from. And so what I say, and selfistry is built on this, the practice, the exploration, the personal journey. But what I can do because of my experience is help you narrow it down so you don't have to spend 10 years. But it is a lifelong journey. It's not like it just happens like that.
Well, that was the next question. It was like, are there parts of your own experience that you do not advocate other people partaking in? Things where you could say, you know what, I did that. Let me save you some time here.
You know, Jeff, the one thing that I often come back to is the heartbreak around how I treated my family in doing that journey. And so that is the one thing that I underscore with my students is you do not have to blow up your life. You do not have to push anybody out of it. You may have to for a while or renegotiate that relationship. But within the context of your life, it is possible to be selfish in the sense that I'm talking about, which means carve out time for yourself, which a lot of people don't feel like they have permission to do. And in carving out time for yourself, not so much to go get a pedicure or a massage, though those are wonderful things to do, but actually embark on this journey of self-inquiry.
How tough a message is that to impart, though, to take time for yourself? I mean, yeah, we can get into the Calgon bath oil bead commercials and stuff like that, but you know, really taking time to think about your own life and your own condition in a world where you have something on your hip that is asking for your attention 24 hours a day. Now you're being asked to like walk down the streets with Pokemon characters. I don't know if you heard about that, too. So all sorts of things that are like, your attention needs to be here now. We're being told all the time, and yet you're saying, in essence, say no.
Stop. I'm saying stop. And it's precisely because of the intensity of these times and the challenges that we face as a human species, socially, politically, environmentally, that I say we need to now more than ever get in touch with that part of ourselves that is connected to what is sacred, what is mysterious, what is holy, so that we can find our place in this changing world and not do crazy things like pull out a gun and shoot somebody because we don't like the color of their skin or we don't like what they just said to us. We live in very, very intense times, and this kind of selfishness that I'm advocating for, I feel is essential for us to move forward in a way that honors our humanity and our planet.
How much of a caveat does this come with up front, though? You know, you don't want people saying, you know, I decided as of today I am a selfist. and they, you know, got no time for you. You know, I imagine there's a level of caution you would like people to take at the beginning.
Yes, and I would say at this point, probably you could err on the side of taking a little bit more time for yourself in the way that I'm advocating, even 10 minutes a day. And there's so many fabulous teachers nowadays that are, and you mentioned Cheryl Strayed, you know, Liz Gilbert, Brené Brown, one of my teachers, Ken Wilber in the Integral Lineage, Diane Hamilton, here in Southern Oregon, Jean Houston. There's so many wonderful people coming forward with this kind of message. And I think there's a lot more room to be selfish in the way that I'm talking about it.
A bit of a blend of Eastern and Western traditions that you come from and have worked through. Is there, I can imagine, though, that given the profusion of spiritual traditions in the world, there's a lot of places you haven't explored. Are there more you still want to explore? Have you gotten to a place where you're like, I'm good?
Both. Yeah, I feel really good and really curious still. I think what you'll discover with Selfistry is that I've broken it down to kind of to the essentials. So there's a way in which I'm an essentialist. I have a deep resonance with the Zen lineage in that regard. But I always think there's more to learn. And there's so many beautiful lineages and traditions and teachings on the planet and creativity. And I don't think I would ever totally shut down to something new.
What is your general sense of religion in the world today? And we're talking about, you know, longstanding spiritual traditions, none that you appear to adhere to at the moment. But what's your thought about what religion does for people in the world today?
I think we're in sore need of upgrading our operating system when it comes to religion is one way that I could say that. I think there's a lot of beauty in the religions that exist on the planet today, and there's a lot of blind coherence to those religions that I would advocate for a new conversation and sharing of those religions in a way that is mindful and respectful and yet willing to open to, well, what is the essential piece in your religion that's also in mine? So we don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but we really need to look again. And I really advocate for what you just said earlier, to stop and slow down and take a look and ask a question.
Was there any point, particularly in the 10 years of retreat, when you just said, screw this, I'm an atheist from now on?
There was always the mysterious or the mystery or curiosity that would continue to surface. So I never got to a point where I would say, I don't believe in anything. Where I continue to land is there's something going on here that is pretty awesome. And I want to be a part of it in the best way that I can be.
Sarah Marshank lives in Southern Oregon. Her book is Being Selfish, an Unorthodox Memoir. It espouses her view of selfistry. You can find out more about it at her website, which is linked from ours at jeffexchange.org. Sarah Marshank, thanks so much for joining us today in The Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff. It's been a delight.